I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Using a bit of a shorter musical intro for the time being as I ramp up production on these episodes. I know some people like the longer, more cinematic style intro of Parallax Views, but some people just want to cut right to the chase, and right now, I think that's very useful given the times we find ourselves in. With that being said, on this edition of the program, returning guest and veteran journalist Albert Lanier joins myself and semi-regular at this point co-host Casey from the Parallax Views current events program, The Week That Was, to discuss the economic side of the coronavirus pandemic, as well as giving his thoughts on the 2020 election. Very interesting conversation, as always, with Albert Lanier. If you haven't yet checked out my previous episodes with Albert and you're stuck at home, I highly recommend listening to them. He is a great journalist with very, very unique and interesting commentary. And with that being said, why don't we get right into the conversation with Albert Lanier on the economic side of the coronavirus crisis. Welcome back to Parallax Views, good friend of the show, one of my favorite journalists to have on the program, although we're having you on at a very tumultuous and anxious time in America and the world. Albert Lanier, how are you doing today?
So far, so good. And as I usually say, alive. And that really has more of a meaning nowadays than it has in the past.
And of course, we're also joined by my Parallax Views, The Week That Was co-host. That's the show for my Patreon supporters. We're having my co-host Casey on for a few of the main feed episodes as of late. Casey, how are you doing today?
Pretty good, all things considered. Offside the show, I just got some groceries, some cans of soup, and chicken broth so I can make something that's not microwavable.
But full disclosure, you were actually the reason I was able to get supplies today, so thank you for that. I think we've all been stocking up on supplies lately. It feels like we're in a whole new reality. Maybe that's where we could start. Albert, what do you think of this new reality we find ourselves in, or is it a new reality? Are we overreacting? What is going on?
Well, I've heard in the time that I've been sort of shut in here in Hawaii, my place in Hawaii, I've been sort of, watching, which I never do, watch speeches by senators and other members of Congress. And some of them have used the term unprecedented.
I was just going to ask, how long have you been sort of shut in, like the self-quarantining? When did that start for you?
I would say at least the last couple of days. I had to go out and eat because I knew, based on the trends that were happening in other cities like Los Angeles, for example, San Francisco, New York to a certain extent, that eventually bars and restaurants would close here in Honolulu. And so I wanted to go out and eat out to some extent, to the best extent that I could. And I think I've been indoors at least a couple of days, 2-3 days maybe.
And are you all good on supplies yourself, or I'm hoping you are?
So far, so good.
So you were saying you've been watching senators' speeches, maybe on, I don't know, C-SPAN or another network. Go on. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry for being so rude.
No, that's fine. So I normally don't watch speeches by senators or members of Congress. But using the term unprecedented, and in terms of the economic impact, which is probably what I'll be getting to, moving on to other things, it might be unprecedented in terms of the impact of a health condition like this and how it's caused, obviously, some degree of chaos. And I'm probably underestimating that but it's not unprecedented when we look at the historical aspects of epidemics or pandemics. What I would compare this to on a global scale, though not in terms of lethality or death toll, is the Spanish influenza of the early 20th century. I think the precedent is there in terms of the global impact. Now, I want to be very careful in saying that Spanish influenza killed far more people than this virus is currently. I think historians in the 21st century have argued that the Spanish influenza, which occurred, I believe it was 1917, 1918, during the First World War, and then after, I think up until 1920, I think the symptoms presented until the 50s, in fact. But the contagion raged, I think, from the late teens of the 20th century until about the 20s. That it killed an estimated now about 50 to 100 million people. And of course, it was far worse. I won't go into the symptoms. People can look it up on Google and on YouTube if they wish, but I would say the precedent for a global pandemic occurred with the Spanish influenza. What I would argue is not that this health crisis, first of all, I don't think this is simply a health crisis. I think it's primarily an economic crisis coupled to a health crisis. And I just finished posting this on Facebook and stating this. You're seeing the impact to this country and to parts of the planet of this COVID-19/coronavirus pandemic epidemic. So what we have now is an economic crisis. And my argument is, and my argument for I don't know how long has been that the U.S. economy in particular, and maybe some aspects of the global economy, but the U.S. economy in particular doesn't work. And it doesn't work because it's a low-wage economy. It's what I call a reductive economy as opposed to a productive economy. We've gone from manufacturing prior to, in the 50s and the 40s and in the previous century to a reductive economy, economy that's based on retail and service industry work. And lower wages as opposed to livable wages that were provided through factory work, manufacturing in the 20th century. So we've gone from a productive economy, in my view, that's my term for it, to a reductive economy, reducing the wages, reducing the value of jobs, reducing the kind of jobs that people have. And so I see this as an economic crisis, probably much more than a health crisis. Which is not to say that the health factor isn't important. It is. But you have to look at what the toll is. How I would place it in a context historically is to state that it's kind of like what the Soviet Union used to do in terms of its armies, in World War II especially. It would have rear guards. And so what would happen is soldiers would have to go up to the front and fight whatever enemy, primarily the Germans. And if any of them ran away or tried to run away from the action, they would get shot down by this rear guard. I view the economic crisis as that rear guard forces or those rear forces, and that the health crisis is like the front line. But I view this as primarily an economic crisis. China, for example, which got hit by this COVID-19 coronavirus epidemic, they shut down their factories. They're just now beginning to get back to a semblance of normal life in China after having fought this virus. And you're seeing it in the U.S. I mean, you're seeing wages being lost because jobs are lost. You're seeing people at home. I think it's Casey, the co-host. I believe he lost his job. Am I right about that?
You would be correct. And I've got a few questions I want to ask, but first I want to hear your points fully laid out. But you are correct.
Right. So my analysis of this is that the impact of this, I think the greater impact, what this crisis underlines is the anemic American economy and what this economy has become. I think it's become an economy that doesn't really work for, to put it in popular terms, the 99%. It works for the 1%. And we're seeing that every day. Who are the people that are suffering the most? The working class, the poor, even the homeless.
Can I comment real quick?
Consider because it could, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's been very interesting seeing all the reactions with regards to the essential workers, so the people working at places like gas stations or grocery stores. And I hear more and more people saying, these people are the heroes of this. And I've been saying, well, yeah, they're also the backbone of this society. Guess what? It turns out that the CEOs, the hedge fund managers, the stock market gamblers, they're not the backbone of this. Where are they?
Well, they're in their mansions. They're in their summer homes. They're in their cabins. They're in their retreats. Hold up, probably. Just like the rest of us are holed up in our apartments and our houses and other kinds of dwellings and places, you know. But your point is a good one. And it goes to another point that I've made, and that is that capitalism has basically been shoved aside in this crisis. Because capitalism, especially neoliberal economics, has turned out to be utterly useless and worthless in a crisis such as this. And so you're seeing what's happening with the president. What is the president doing? Well, what he's essentially doing, and I haven't heard anyone say this but myself, which I find odd, but most people, you know, I've heard people say, well, he's outflanking the left or he's outlefting the left. No, he's not quite doing that. What he's doing is he's appropriating New Deal economic policy, a New Deal economic construct and political construct, and putting it to work right now. And I would argue the post-New Deal construct as well. You're looking at the 1950 Defense Production Act being put into play, getting the private sector, especially companies, to produce masks, to produce other kinds of medical equipment like ventilators, because you're seeing places like New York in particular state, the mayor coming out and saying the hospitals will run out of supplies. They will run out of equipment in a matter of weeks. And so they need more equipment. In fact, I believe with the mayor, Bill de Blasio, was just frustrated and I guess furious at the federal government for what he believes is their inaction in this area, especially as regards New York City, which is the city that has, I believe at this point, if not the most COVID-19 or coronavirus infection cases, then at least close to it. I mean, I think they are the epicenter of that, of this crisis in regards to a single American city. So what you're seeing is that capitalism, especially neoliberal free market economics, has proved utterly unable to do the job. It's utterly unable to get the job done. And that's the problem that you're seeing in this essence. In essence, what the president's doing is expropriating New Deal economic policies, New Deal economic framework. And in some respects, also what Bernie Sanders has been saying as well, and what he's been advocating as well. Suddenly, Medicare for All doesn't look so bad. Suddenly, the idea of better wages for workers and issues that impact employees seem relevant. And because people are losing jobs, they're losing work, they're losing livelihoods, you're seeing rates of unemployment go up. You're seeing the last figure I saw, 2.5 million. I think that was Goldman Sachs. Don't trust Goldman Sachs, but let's go with that figure, which is an enormous figure or a large figure. I think that would be a record if it's actually true. So you're seeing people filing for unemployment, people out of work, people with no jobs, people with no careers even, and businesses shutting bars, restaurants, live venues, sports leagues canceling their seasons. We're seeing that the free markets, we're seeing that neoliberal economics, that capitalism isn't up to the task. It's been shunted aside. This New Deal economic framework, this New Deal political framework has essentially been put in place. And this post-New Deal framework, I would also argue, has been put in place by, of all people, President Trump.
Can I interject really briefly?
Yes,
I think
ahead.
There's one thing you haven't mentioned, and that's what I've been calling sort of the UBI scheme in the midst of all of this, this idea that we're going to give a $1,000 check to every American. And to me, that's not necessarily New Deal. And you didn't – I will say you didn't mention this aspect of it, so I'm not saying that you're saying it's a New Deal type thing. But I find it very interesting. A lot of people are getting behind it, and I understand why. I think in the immediate, in the short term, it can be very good. My concern is that once we get a vaccine, and if this ends up slowing down, you know, say 12, 18 months down the line, if they're going to normalize this UBI sort of scheme and then start making cuts to things like Social Security and Medicare.
Right. Well, we know that the president wanted to basically wipe out payroll. I think he had mentioned, you know, at least for the foreseeable future, getting rid of payroll or advocating getting rid of payroll taxes. It's interesting bringing up the whole UBI aspect, universal basic income. I was a critic of Andrew Yang. First of all, he took something that had been around for years, the idea of a universal income, of a basic income, I think it was just known years ago, and basically using it as a gimmick, as a prop for his campaign, the central organizing theme of his campaign. In this context of this economic crisis, the idea of cash payment makes sense. Because people need some kind of economic inflow, because their jobs are gone, because their wages are gone, and their incomes are slowly, or not even slowly dwindling, they're being reduced. And they have to pay rent, they have to pay all kinds of credit card bills and other kind of bills. They have to pay at least some expenses here. If not, food and supplies. They've got to go to stores and get food and supplies so they'll have something to eat and something to use, you know, whether it's a mask, whether it's some other kinds of protective equipment. And so the idea of providing people with cash payments or checks at this point in time is, it makes absolute sense. But my view of that outside of this crisis has been critical, because I view UBI outside of this crisis as nothing more than a sort of bribe to the populace. It's a payoff. It's a way that the corporate class, the donor class, have of trying to buy people off. And I have to stress, though, that at this time, in this context, there has to be some kind of payment to the population. There has to be a bailout to the American population. So they need to be bailed out. I know the airline industry wants a bailout. They want $50 billion. I don't know if they've received it thus far. But I think it was a union leader, I think her name, I don't remember her name, but a union leader for flight attendants came out and said that there should be no bailout for the airlines unless wages are factored in for employees and other kinds of financial restitution is made to employees.
You're thinking of Sarah Nelson of the airs of the
right, precisely.
I can't remember what the particular union is, but it's in the AFL-CIO.
Mm-hmm. So again, my point would be, a bailout of the American population at this point, especially those impacted directly by loss of jobs and loss of wages, is crucial at this point. It needs to happen.
Casey, anything you wanted to add? I've been wanting to give you more room to maybe dialogue with the guests we have on the program.
And I appreciate that, even though my contributions are admittedly kind of minimal. So, like, on a mortality level, I'm pretty sure Spanish flu had, like, a 2.5% mortality rate, and coronavirus can be anywhere between 0.5% to 7%. So, we don't know. But I think you're spot on, Albert, when you say that this is more of an economic crisis, that we're facing a 25% unemployment rate, and that's frankly unprecedented, even in the context of the Great Depression. And I read an article in Washington Post that was posted earlier today that kind of this whole conversation reminded me of, where hospitals are running short on cash, and that means that they wouldn't be able to do payroll, so they'd have to close down, and they won't be able to get supplies because they can't buy them from vendors. And just the idea of hospitals having to buy needed life-saving equipment in the middle of a pandemic just astounds me.
Well, when you have a for-profit medical system and a for-profit healthcare system, then you're going to have to have, then you're going to see hospitals that can run out of equipment, can run out of supplies, and can run out of gear, protective and otherwise, during a major crisis like this. Again, this is endemic of what neoliberal economics and what free markets on steroids do. I mean, what we have had is an economic system that at least since the 70s, as I outlined in my blog, I believe it was Are You Now or Have You Ever Been a Capitalist, has been captured by the corporate class and the sort of the business community because of what the, to use it as a blueprint, the Lewis Powell memo of 1971 to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, in which Powell outlined the need to fight against popular movements by taking over or corralling or taking over the political system, the educational system, and among others. And so what we see is a consequence of the kind of society that has been built up and has been constructed since then. This sort of free market dominated system on steroids, this kind of system which is profit based, and where even in a crisis, nothing goes to waste. You could see that by some of the members of the U.S. Senate that managed to profit as a result of this COVID-19/coronavirus crisis by selling stock off early and making thousands, if not millions of dollars from it. So we're seeing an indictment of our economic system and maybe for some other countries, their economic systems as well. But primarily in this country, it's an indictment of this economic system. It's an indictment of neoliberalism. It's an indictment of a free market dominated approach to everything that doesn't keep in mind basic component systems like the healthcare system. We're seeing an indictment of just the way our economics work in this country. And if that lesson isn't learned after this crisis, whenever it abates, you're going to get the next crisis that happens, whether it's a health crisis or a terrorism crisis or whatever, because terrorism crises also create economic dislocation, as we saw with 9/11 in 2001. You'll have the same tactics and the same kind of oppression to the working classes and to the poor of this country and to others who aren't part of the 1%, or as I like to call it, top 10%, and are in the 90%. We're seeing it play out right now. And that's why I have said, at least in the past couple of years, that we look at this country economically, it simply doesn't work. You can't have a country that's dependent upon, as I mentioned before, a reductive economy, which is retail-based, which is service economy-based, which pays low wages, which pays little to no benefits for many workers. That's why sick leave is an issue now, because some of them aren't even able to get out of some jobs. I mean, a lot of people have lost jobs, but some of them can't even leave their job because they don't have sick leave. So we're seeing I don't know how to put this without, I'm trying to put this in a way that doesn't sound like I'm saying I told you so, but I warned of the kind of, to use the obvious term, sick economic system we have. And we're seeing just how sick this system is. This system that we have today is as sick as any person who can catch any kind of infection or gets any kind of disease. We have a diseased economic system.
I'm sorry. I'm just reminded of a meme I keep seeing online of some Twitter post that's an example of the excesses of neoliberal capitalism, and below it is like the first page of Das Kapital, but instead of saying Das Kapital, it's I told you so, you motherfuckers. I told you so. And this whole conversation just kind of reminds me of that these issues have been pertinent and ongoing, that there is a cyclical nature to them that has been reoccurring at least since the 16th century, and has only magnified as our productive faculties have expanded. But more generally, I guess all of that is a decent enough segue to get to what I think is a pertinent question, which is, what is to be done? Like, what now that the working class is made bluntly aware of what strategic industries exist and is in such a precarious situation that has been developing for the past, admittedly, 40 years, then what collective actions can be embarked upon? What is the nature of our struggle, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask.
Well, I, on Facebook, kind of advocated and noted some things I think that need to be done once the health crisis aspect, the viral aspect, the immunological aspect of this crisis is over, to the best extent. What needs to be done, and I don't believe it will be done, to be brutally honest, but what needs to be done is that wages for many industries and many jobs need to be raised. Employers need to raise wages. They need to provide some benefits like sick leave. They need to be able, the U.S. has to get back, and this is one reason why I don't think this will happen. The U.S. has to get back to manufacturing products within its own country. I'm not a huge Uber nationalist like the president is, 45. But clearly, my view has been that I have to admit that manufacturing is important, and I believe that manufacturing is important within any country. And domestically, the U.S. needs to revitalize and completely get back into having a more robust and sustained manufacturing economy. They need to produce a number at least of their own products. A lot of reliance is on China and other countries to produce because they're low wage producers, and they're also it's a lot easier to go to other countries where you can pay people less money and be able to produce these products, have these products produced and be able to sell them for much higher rates because your labor costs are lower. We need to get back to having manufacturing in this country that can provide some semblance of living wages, which is where I mentioned wages previous to this. We also need to find a way, and again, I don't think this will happen, to control markets and keep them under some kind of ring. This market approach to everything, this market domination, has to come to an end. It has to come to an end. So those are just some of the points that I brought up that needs to be done. I don't think they'll be done. I mean, you have the 1950 Defense Production Act, and, you know, supposedly companies are going to step up and produce some of these aspects, like masks and other equipment, maybe ventilators, we'll see. But I really don't think this will be done, and that's why I believe that the response after this crisis economically will be crucial, and I think it'll be back to business. Maybe there'll be some slight changes in terms of the economy, but I think they'll go back to business, which is back to a sick economic system and a neoliberal and free market dominated economic system that keeps the working class down and keeps the upper class wealthy and comfortable.
I guess I'm even more pessimistic than you then, because I'm afraid after this crisis is over and all the deficit spending that we've already embarked upon just in a week of it, it will result in an ever deepening austerity, I guess, that government spending will be curtailed as much as possible, and thus even though it would itself precipitate an ever deepening of the looming recession, if not the one that we already live in, I think that is the only option that politicians will think they have if we're thinking purely in like political lenses.
You know, that's a good point. I think austerity may very well happen, at least some minor version of it. It's very clear that the so-called Trump economy is being destroyed. It's being destroyed before our very eyes. Unemployment rates were down, but of course what was also down were wage rates. So you had a good deal of productivity. You certainly had low unemployment. You had an economy that was humming. And certainly, not only were companies doing very well, of course they were, a number of them weren't paying any taxes, like Amazon, but also these CEOs and these heads of corporations were also doing very well. And now you have a situation where this economy has basically been completely and utterly thrown into the garbage bin, into trash cans, and now it's got to be reconstructed. And so the Trump tax cuts, which worked for a little while, and in my previous article about the Trump administration on my blog, which was titled "Our Brand is Crisis: The First Year of the Trump Presidency," the point that I made about the Trump administration is that he was largely, in my view, made the nominee by the Republican Party and swept into office because he was going to push through this tax cut, which he did. And that is the jewel of his administration. That is the jewel of his term. Whether this is the first term or second term, we don't know yet. But that is the jewel of his term. The other major achievement of his administration, of course, is the judiciary and ramming through as many judges and confirming as many federal judges as possible. Those are his two major achievements. But getting back to the major achievement, which is the tax cut. Now you have the Trump economy, which is basically leveled at this point. There may be something approaching a Great Depression, if not maybe a Great Recession, maybe not 2000, maybe not 2008, but worse than 2008, because we're looking at numbers that are bad. You mentioned 25%. I've seen numbers of 20% in terms of unemployment. The speed that this has taken place in regards to lost jobs and lost wages and businesses shutting down is lightning fast. It's faster, certainly, than the Great Depression. So we're seeing, I don't want to say the end of the Trump economy, but certainly the destruction of the Trump economy before our very eyes. How that economy is going to be rebuilt probably will be a lot of the same. But I certainly believe it will be business as usual after this crisis.
Do you think that you say that the sort of Trump economy is going to collapse? And you also mentioned that you're not, you know, big into Trump's nationalism. But I think figures like, well, I've mentioned him on previous shows lately, Pat Buchanan, who just wrote an article, an op-ed entitled, "Will Coronavirus Kill the New World Order?" And I think that Buchanan is dog whistling when he says New World Order, but that's another story for another time. I worry that figures like Buchanan, who are very hyper-nationalistic, are very much going to take advantage of this crisis, this chaos.
Well, it's interesting. You have to understand, let me just go back a little. For those who aren't aware, they may not be aware that Trump ran for president initially in 2000 on the Reform Party ticket. The major Reform Party candidate was Pat Buchanan. And I think in many respects, what Trump has done since he ran for president and then became president is steal Pat Buchanan's nationalist focus. I think he basically ripped that off like he's done everything else. He's probably as big a plagiarist and as an appropriator as Joe Biden. And Joe Biden's a major appropriator and plagiarist. But Trump is an even greater one. He's just better at it than Joe. And I think that's what he did. He basically took Pat Buchanan's nationalist focus and nationalist-centered focus, which was also sort of ethnocentric and, in many respects, white nationalist and supremacist, and used it for his own purposes, using immigration as a focus. And so it's interesting you bring up Pat Buchanan, because for all his flaws, and he has many of them, Buchanan is actually a rather sharp-eyed observer of the American scene and some aspects of the American political scene. But that's befitting somebody who was basically a guy who ghostwrote for Richard Nixon during his campaign and worked in the Nixon White House. I mean, he was somebody who worked in Republican administration.
I agree completely with you. I was just going to add, I think it's worth noting what Buchanan is saying and where he is going, because if you disagree with him, he's one of the smarter people behind enemy lines, if you will. I think he's dangerous in a way.
Well, he was considered dangerous in the 90s. Remember that he ran for the Republican nomination in 1992, and he was the guy who coined the term culture war. And if you look at what's happened with the right, essentially what we have had since the end of the Cold War, this is another issue, I'm just bringing it up briefly, is for the Republicans, to some extent libertarians, for the right in general, has been a focus on domestic issues and a focus on social justice. When they complain about social justice warriors, when they complain about safe spaces, when they complain about identity politics, that is a feature of right-wing media and the right-wing blogosphere and the right-wing structure, media structure. And that has been primarily domestic-oriented. It's the culture war, to use Buchanan's phrase. But that's another issue for another time. But I think bringing up Buchanan is very interesting. Like I said, I think Trump expropriated and appropriated Buchanan's nationalist outlook and used it for his own purposes. And basically just swiped it for his campaign. After all, he swiped up everything else. His campaign slogan was "Make America Great Again," which was the slogan essentially of the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980. and used the term silent majority, which Richard Nixon coined. I mean, he's an appropriator of a great many things, Donald Trump. So that doesn't surprise me. But Pat Buchanan's very interesting. Whether you like him or not, I have issues with Buchanan because he's an outright racist. It's ironic, he's a racist. He had a black woman running with him for president when he was an independent candidate, which is odd. But he's a racist nonetheless. And but he is a very sharp observer of the American scene. And I've read his columns, and I've read his book. And he's far more intelligent than a lot of these so-called right-wing media voices out there. Very sharp man, whether or not you like him or not, whether you agree with him or not, and I don't agree with him on a great deal, with the 90% of what he says. Still, I find him 10 times sharper and 10 times more intelligent.
It sounds like you do agree with him on some things, though. What are they?
Oh, geez. I'm going to go back. I think he's made some very good points. I'd have to go back to his books and try to remember. I disagree with him on so many things. It's like, what do I agree with Pat?
Is it like free trade issues, stuff like NAFTA, or?
Yeah, maybe. I don't agree with him on the culture war. I see where that's been used and appropriated by other people in the right, and why the right-wing media have used it to their advantage, disadvantage. It's funny, you got me at a loss here, because I'm going, what do I agree with Pat Buchanan on? I never thought I'd be asked that question.
See, I think we've run into a problem where, in the necessity of like being human, we can all recognize that on some level, like you agree with someone else on some things. So we'll throw out a large number, like 90% disagreement, when really we mean like 99 or 100. But we just don't know. And I think one does not need to name all the things you agree with Pat Buchanan to say that, like, maybe he doesn't like murdering kittens, and I can kind of agree with that. So that's a part of that 10%.
Well, no, I'm not trying to be what the kids are calling a woke school these days, but I think where some people are seeing Buchanan right now and maybe having agreement is what you said earlier, Albert, that we may need to bring manufacturing back to America.
Well, to me, that's if that's because I haven't read his books in a long time. I haven't read anything from Pat in a long time. And I feel kind of odd right now, because normally I would call up stuff that I've read and call up stuff that I've, you know, seen. But Pat's stuff, I'm going, I'm drawing a blank, I guess, because I disagree with him so much. And, you know, but that's a good point. If he does believe in manufacturing, I don't remember if he does. The reason I say that is because it's pragmatic. I mean, I look at the change in the American economy that's gone from a manufacturing-based economy to a financial-based economy, where it's not about making products, it's about creating debt and shipping it off and making money from debt. It's about manipulating stock. It's about manipulating, it's about interest rates, and it's about making money from the manipulation of dollars, you know. So that's one of the changes that I would cite in terms of the economy, whereas in the mid-20th century, it was a manufacturing-based economy. It's basically become a financially-based economy. You know, Wall Street dominates this economy like no other sector in this country. I mean, in my view, the Wall Street runs things, whether it's the banks, whether it's insurance companies, you name it.
Well, it's certainly not Main Street running things.
Right. I'm sure Joe Biden, if he were an honest man, and I don't believe he is, would tell you that, but he won't, because he's controlled by credit card companies, banks, and probably insurance in his home state of Delaware. At least the state he represented in the Senate, Delaware.
Yeah, because he's famously not a He's famously, when he's running for president, actually from, what, Scranton, PA or something? Like, good working class town. I just happen to be in the pocket of all these multi-billion dollar companies. But
right.
I think there's something to be said, though, about the subconsciousness of American people, where, like, you don't get a movie like The Wolf of Wall Street to be as popular and big as it is without there being a cultural understanding that that's already kind of going on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I on some level, I can't help but think that when leftists or people say these things like Wall Street controls everything, like regular folk, lay people, if we're going to go old school on it, would just nod their head and be like, well, yeah, but what am I going to do about it?
Right. Well, that's what they want you to think. They want you to be someone who says, well, I agree. They don't want you to agree, but they say, well, I agree, but what can we do? I just have to, I'm just a lowly mechanic. I'm just a lowly janitor. I'm just a lowly clerk in a 7-Eleven.
You know, I just got to pull myself up by my bootstraps, you know?
Well, this is a good segue for something I wanted to bring up.
Kind of hard to... Right.
Go on,
kind of hard
Albert.
To pull yourself up by your bootstrap if you don't have bootstraps. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say this is a good segue. The New York Post, Maureen Callahan, is reporting that coronavirus leads to class warfare in the Hamptons. Real quick, there is a sudden influx of rich Manhattanites panic fleeing to the Hamptons. These rich Manhattanites are fleeing to Manhattan and bringing coronavirus with them. And it's interesting, there's a really choice quote here. We're at the end of Long Island, the tip, and waves of people are bringing this, I'll just say it, shit, says lifelong Montauker James Katsipas. And he continues, we should blow up the bridges. Don't let them in. This is class warfare happening in real time.
Well, it's interesting because if you look at the break of, look at coronavirus, from what I understand, you look at Italy, which is one of the countries impacted by the coronavirus, tremendously impacted by the coronavirus. I mean, you're looking at several hundred people dying in one day in Italy, tremendous numbers. But if you look at the way, my understanding of the spread of that virus in Italy was in places like Milan, where it was an epicenter, what they did was try to cut off that portion of the country. So they tried to cut off the portion of the country. And what happened was that people fled from Milan. They left Milan. They left that area. And they went to other parts of Italy. So if you look at what you cited with the New York Times there, people in Manhattan, where we know in New York City alone, New York City has probably the highest rate for the coronavirus and COVID-19 outbreak. They're going to Hamptons, which is outside the city, and those who have it and either aren't aware of it or are aware of it are potentially in a position to spread it to others. And so it makes sense. Maybe it's extreme to say they should blow up the bridges, but it's understandable. You can understand the mentality of people who are saying, look, they're bringing it. It's kind of that out. You can see where it's traveled, and you can see that response has worsened it. And that's what happened in Italy, too, from what I understand of the virus. But the class warfare aspect, again, that ties to what I mentioned about this being an economic crisis.
If I could add really quickly, the gist of this article was that the working class people in pockets of the Hamptons, like, say, East Hampton, a very working class pocket of the Hamptons, they're mad. They're saying we can't get vegetables anymore because these, they're calling them elitist people, are hoarding everything. You're seeing class warfare foment in this area where the rich have traditionally gone to vacation and party. And the working class are just like, no, we're sick of this. This is a pandemic we're in.
That's true, but you have to understand those attitudes likely existed prior to this pandemic, to this epidemic. So you had working class people in Montauk and in that and in the Hamptons who probably felt you have these wealthy people, they've got the resources, they've got the capital, they're able to go and take up the choice, not just areas in the Hamptons, but also resources within that part of New York. And I think those attitudes have been there for a long time, but they're magnified by this crisis. So you're seeing the class aspect of this come out, because they're going, people are saying, we're sick and tired of this. We're fed up. But these attitudes have existed for quite a while. It's nothing new, not out of the ordinary. They're just surfacing now. They're just coming up out of the woodwork. So that's what you've got to look at.
Meanwhile, The Intercept just reported on March 19th, Li Fang reported that banks pressure healthcare firms to raise prices on critical drugs, medical supplies for coronavirus. Now, I'm not saying to comment specifically on that story, but it seems like there is a real... The tensions of class are now coming to the forefront. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know if this is just a short-term thing, if it'll be a long-term thing, but I'm interested in your take on this and what effect it will have on us economically.
Well, as I mentioned before, I believe that after this crisis, the health aspect of this crisis, or I should say the health crisis, when it abates, there will be a return to basically neoliberal economic thinking, to the dominance of markets. It may be stymied a bit. It may be, you know, kind of hidden through so-called reforms. But I think there'll be a return to, as they would have said in the 20s, normalcy, at least what passes for normalcy in the United States, which is, to my mind, not normal. What we see in terms of class is the basic class cleavages made raw and made pure in this crisis. Again, working class people, poor people, get the short end of the stick. They don't get the resources, whether that's supplies like masks or other coverings they need to protect themselves, food. The people going to stores, and there's panic buying of all kinds of things, including toilet paper, food and other things like toilet paper and other kinds of supplies, to such an extent that they've had to stagger the hours, they have to have senior citizen hours in some of these stores. You're seeing the cleavages of class made apparent in the loss of jobs and the loss of wages and paychecks, and in the lack of opportunities for working class people and for working people in general. They don't have their jobs in bars. They don't have their jobs in restaurants. They don't have their jobs at sporting events or auditoriums or other venues. What will they do? And this is what I pointed out again before when I said that we have an economy that teaches people to go get a job, but doesn't give them much in the way of a job to survive with, and much in the way of wages to survive on. And where do you go when the job's gone? Where do you go when the paycheck's gone? Where do you go when your resources deriving from, which depend on your ability to have a job and a paycheck, go? And so we're seeing that as a part of the class cleavage and an indication of the differences in class. You know, when you look at the creative classes, the upper middle classes, the educated largely, those who are able to work from home, what's become apparent is the role of the gig economy and the ability of people to work from home as opposed to work outside of the home, in workplaces, in sites, work sites, in offices, in bars, restaurants, and other establishments.
There's a nice...
Sort of,
I'm sorry. Go on.
No. We're seeing, to finish it up, we're seeing the haves and the have-nots, but not just in terms of wealth, the rich and the poor, but also in terms of the kind of work, work at home as opposed to work outside the home. And I think that's become a major, major cleavage in a way that it wasn't before this crisis. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you're absolutely right. This is highlighting how for millions of people that they never had to go to the office. For countless disabled people that were told that they had to go to class or they had to go get accommodations to work, they couldn't do it from home. But apparently when all this is happening, they could have this whole time, to say nothing of the brewing resentment that must be fermenting among, for example, grocery store workers as opposed to office workers.
Right.
I'm just thinking, though, why I was about to interrupt you earlier was that it's a nice kind of circularity, I suppose, where 500 or 1,000 years ago, most people were producing their socially valuable goods in home, and now millions of people have gone back to producing their socially valuable goods at home.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Right.
The quirks of fate, I guess.
Well, that's why I mentioned that part of my analysis of it is to say we've gone from a productive economy to a reductive economy. And of course, in terms of human beings in general, but also specifically in this country, what's happened, the shifts that have occurred, we've gone from being independent to dependent. So, because it used to be many, many decades ago, people had to rely on their innate ability to create the goods and create the structures that they needed to survive with. And now, of course, that's taken up by various companies and corporations and outfits. But we see that people are dependent. So we've gone from an independent society to a dependent society. And a dependent society can work, of course, to a certain extent. But when crises occur and things break down, you're not able to be dependent.
I'm sorry. Right. Go on. I completely agree with that, Ed. I was just talking with our co-host earlier today about the Bronze Age collapse. And over the course of 100 years, you have these interconnected societies because the nature of creating bronze, the foundation block upon these ancient complex civilizations, required international trade links. You couldn't get copper and tin unless you were having trade with some other people somewhere. And as crises multiplied and built off of each other, as there was plagues and famines and wars, all of it over the course of a century, like a parallel to the 21st century, led to the collapse of civilizations people knew it so completely that in some regions they completely lost the art of writing. And I can't help but feel like coronavirus is a great leap forward along that seemingly inevitable progression, unless there is some meaningful response by the working class to avert it.
You know, I hate having to say, again, I hate to be in a position where I said, I told you so. Because it sounds like I'm a person who is basically wagging his finger at the American economic system and American lawmakers and other aspects of this country. But I told you so.
Albert, real quickly, I just want to say, I don't think you should have to apologize for that. I've been telling people in the past few days, people keep saying, well, why is it that America could put a man on the moon, but they can't keep up with testing the way China can? And I've said to them, because you live in a country that likes its federalism. We like our Reaganism. And this is what happens when you have federalism and Reaganism under the conditions of a pandemic. I won't apologize for that. I will wag my finger a little bit.
Well, I would say I don't like to be in a position to say I told you so. I like to be able to say I brought this out, but I don't like that I told you so mentality.
No,
even
I agree.
I just said all this, I tell you so. That's what I don't like. But I have spoken out against this. I hate sounding like some kind of biblical prophet, which is odd because I'm not religious, but I hate to sound like some prophet, you know, spouting Jeremiah here or having stated a Jeremiah here. But there has to be changes to this country economically because it doesn't work. It doesn't work now. I would argue it didn't work prior to the outbreak of the coronavirus in the United States and COVID-19 crisis in the United States. And it won't continue to work if you go according to the same basic framework of neoliberal economic and market-dominated economy. It's not going to work for the 90% of people in this country. The 90% who work for a living, who have to raise families based on their labor and based on their ability to work outside the home, not within the home. Although people within the home, as I well know, have to make money too, and they raise families. But we have an economic framework in this country that didn't work for most Americans prior to this outbreak. Keep in mind, before this happened, what did you see? You had low unemployment rates, but also low wage rates. The wages were not keeping up with corporate profits, with stock prices that were high, and also for productivity. So yes, companies and corporations were doing well, CEOs were doing well, workers were not. They weren't benefiting, and now they really don't benefit. They're left with nothing. So as always, the working class in this country gets screwed, the poor in this country get screwed, and the wealthy continue to survive and in many cases thrive, even in this crisis. This is what you have. If you don't address this in some meaningful way, you know, you're just going to get more of the same. And if people don't open their eyes and see what's going on right now, they're not gonna try to fight for the kind of systemic and systematic change that they need. This is just blatant. It can easily be seen, but people have to see it, and they have to demand that something is done. Do I think anything will be done? I think very, very minor reforms will come out of this once this health crisis is abated. But I don't think much in the way of real and sustained change economically and fiscally will happen in this country. I just think it'll be more of the same. And that may be pessimistic, but I don't consider it pessimistic. I consider it realistic. But, you know, it's evident to anyone who has eyes to see that this economy does not work. And other economies across the globe are being impacted by this crisis as well. But, you know, dealing with the U.S., I mean, the U.S. has to get back to paying people something approaching a living wage so they can pay their rent, pay their mortgages, pay their bills, and raise their family. And if you get away from that, you just have, if not more of the same, then even worse, beyond the same. And I can't put it any simpler than that. I mean, I hope that's simple. I hope people can understand that. But, you know, that it has to happen. I mean, there's no excuse this time. No excuse.
Before we go, any comments you want to make about the election, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders? There's a lot of talk about, oh, after this, there's no way Trump could win in November. I think it's possible that he still could. I don't know, though. A lot of things seem up in the air right now.
Well, first and foremost, in regards to the elections, I'm just going to put it out there. Joe Biden is not a real frontrunner in this race. He's the official frontrunner at this point. But if you look at what happened in this election, I'm just going to come out and say it. The establishment of the Democratic Party stole the elections. They stole the elections. And they primed the pump for Joe Biden. I know some people are going to oppose what I have to say in that regard, but it's very clear to me that there's monkey business in regards to the election. you're looking at a candidate in Biden who's the best that he did in the first three contests, meaning Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, was second in Nevada. He got over 20% in Nevada, and Bernie Sanders won convincingly in Nevada by over 40%. You saw, not only in terms of the media reaction to Bernie's victories in Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, but also elsewhere, that there was terror in the establishment of that party. They were scared, they were frightened, and they decided to pull the trigger. They decided to pull the trigger, and they decided to invest in Joe, a candidate they didn't really want. I mean, they had him out there as a name candidate. They did nothing to protect him in 2019. He was allowed to stumble and bumble all he needed. They knew he was a completely useless and worthless candidate. They knew that Joe wasn't up to the task and isn't up to the task. This guy has major, major cognitive issues. It's very blatant. I mean, it's like Chauncey Gardner, if anyone's familiar with the movie Being There. It's literally like Chauncey Gardner as a candidate for president. And we know, anyone who's done any basic research in Joe Biden knows that he's never been a successful candidate. He was unsuccessful in the late 80s, in 1988 presidential campaign, where he had to drop out because he blatantly plagiarized speeches from people like Neil Kinnock and Robert Kennedy. We know that he didn't do well in 2008. And he's now begun to win primaries because the establishment basically had other candidates drop out. Now, you have to look at these other candidates. Look at Pete Buttigieg. Now, one of the things that I told people was that, Pete, you have to look at this year's Democratic field. And what the Democrats had were a bunch of candidates. If you look at politics and you look at elections like a chessboard and like a chess game, what they had was several pieces that they could manipulate and they could use. Pete Buttigieg was supposed to be the establishment candidate. They were at the beginning looking to use him and to make him the star. He was, because they had built him up. He was really a nothing mayor from South Bend, Indiana. This is the guy who hadn't even won statewide office. And of course, he's suspicious, of course, because he's Harvard educated. He's a former McKinsey company consultant, and as come out, he had ties to, I think, Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook. I think he had Facebook early, a Facebook page or Facebook early many years ago, or a number of years ago. So you're looking at somebody like Pete Buttigieg. And one of the things that I mentioned on another program was, in my analysis of politics, what happens in elections, I believe, and what I've seen, is what you do is you manipulate elections for political parties. You manipulate elections to get desired results. If you look at the 2008 Republican primary, Mitt Romney was seen as a major contender to John McCain, who was clearly seen as the establishment choice. But Romney was somewhat successful. He was doing pretty well. And then you introduce someone like Mike Huckabee. Huckabee was this governor from Arkansas. I think he'd been a former minister or something along that line. He'd been in media. He was a guy. He never had much money. But Huckabee was put into that race for what reason? He was there to siphon off religious votes from Mitt Romney, because religion is a very big part of the Republican Party. Half the Republican Party consists of what would normally be called the religious right, which is basically evangelicals and Catholics. So what he was able to do, and Mormons, which is what Mitt Romney is, are considered controversial to a lot of these other religious sects within that religious basis. So what they were able to do was take this traditional Protestant pastor, or what have you, or reverend, or whatever he was, they were able to take him and put him up in places like New Hampshire, and he started doing well. Why? Because his job was not to win the presidency. His job was to siphon off votes from Romney. Huckabee never had a lot of money. He was never going to be the candidate. He was never going to be the winner. And so he accomplished his task. And now what is Mike Huckabee doing? This gets to another element that I've noted in terms of elections, which is that candidates don't run for the presidency to win the presidency. Many of them run basically to either increase their speaking circuit fees and make money that way, to write books, or to get a cabinet post later on in the incoming administration if their party wins. And so you look at Mike now, he's basically doing media. He had his own show on Fox. He was on the speaking circuit making money. And so Mike went from a relative nobody to a somebody. He wasn't going to win the presidency, but he accomplished his task. His task was to get Romney out of the race, and he essentially did that. McCain was allowed to come up, and he was able to win enough primaries to get the nomination, which is what they wanted. If you see what happened in this Democratic race, with Pete Buttigieg, he was supposed to be the establishment guy, but Pete and his minions weren't able to steal the Iowa caucus. They weren't able to get the job done, despite the fact that they had delayed the implementation of results in that caucus, that they got Iowa to use the shadow app, which was made by Acronym, this company Acronym. And again, you look at ties from Buttigieg to the high tech sector. They weren't able to steal that caucus. I think one reason was because Pete declared himself the winner before results came out. So he basically kind of gave the game away somewhat, caused suspicion on himself. So Pete ends up being a dud, although he came very close to capturing Iowa. He was supposed to capture Iowa, in my formulation, from what I saw. They would capture Iowa and then kind of do well enough in New Hampshire and move on and become the establishment guy. That didn't work out. He didn't win in New Hampshire. Bernie Sanders did. He certainly didn't win in Nevada. So we also have what I mentioned was a change agent, right? You introduce a candidate. The candidate that's introduced is not Pete Buttigieg, because we know he's the establishment guy, but Mike Bloomberg. Mike Bloomberg comes into the race, and what does he do? He spends millions of dollars. There is I believe the figures are $500 million. That he spent in this race. Now, why was a guy who's worth supposedly $60 to $61 billion going to spend $500 million on a race that he himself knew he couldn't win?
I have to add, real quick, the New York Times and The Hill are both reporting that he actually spent more than $900 million on his failed presidential run, even more than $500 million. But go on.
Well, the last figure I saw was $500 million, but I'm glad you brought that up. I hadn't seen that figure.
Well, it's insane when you think about that number. I mean, oh my God.
Right. Everything I was hearing about Bloomberg, that he was paying his volunteers, he was paying officials top dollar. I mean, I even read one article or saw one article where they talked about the food that was served with Bloomberg. It was like, you know, really good. Top quality food there in his campaign headquarters and in his offices. He's spending millions upon millions of dollars and millions of dollars in ads. Now, why is Mike doing this? Most people thought, well, he'd be a serious contender for the presidency. The party loves him. The party does love him. But see, the party needed him to go into that race. Mike himself had assessed the race and decided not to run. So why is he suddenly running very late in this race? It's to get other candidates out. His job was to get people like Pete Buttigieg out, Amy Klobuchar out, Tom Steyer out, and some of these other candidates. And what happened? After Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar both drop out within days, Steyer had dropped out prior to them. Guess what happens? After Super Tuesday, Mike Bloomberg drops out. After spending millions of dollars, after he said he was thinking of kicking it to the convention. He could have continued to spend money. Money was not an object for him. He could have continued to take this to the convention. He chose not to. And my assessment and analysis is, because he wasn't serious about being the president, he was the change agent in that race. His job was to get other candidates out. He was to get other candidates out. Mike is, for all his flaws, and he has so many flaws, which people can look up on YouTube and look up elsewhere. But this man is no moron. He's a sharp businessman and an intelligent individual. So Mike knows he can't win this race, and wasn't even trying to win the race. He was doing what the Democratic Party wanted him to do, put money into the party and become that change agent that got other candidates out. So these candidates drop out. When you see after I go back, let me go back and correct that. Buttigieg and Klobuchar didn't drop out after Super Tuesday. They dropped out before Super Tuesday, which was odd. They could very well have hung on. They could very well have hung on, and it would have made sense for them to drop out after Super Tuesday. But they didn't. They did it before. Again, why? Again, you're clearing the field for Joe Biden. At some point after Bernie Sanders wins three contests in a row, after they were unable to give the Iowa caucus to Pete Buttigieg, Pete Buttigieg's minions weren't able to steal that away from Bernie Sanders, they decided they're going to pull the trigger, and they're going to have Joe be the guy. They didn't want that. They didn't really need that, but they opted for that because they know that Joe is a complete and total tool of the establishment. He'll do whatever they want. And as much as they probably don't want him to be the man, they're satisfied with him as being the man. And they clear the field. I mean, what you saw in this election was stunning to some extent. I mean, I've seen my share of presidential campaigns. I've covered local elections, and I've seen my share of presidential campaigns from afar, of course. I can't recall a presidential campaign quite like this, where people started dropping out and then lining up to support Biden. You got to keep in mind that Biden was losing. He was losing. He lost Iowa. He lost New Hampshire. At best, at Nevada, which you say he was supposed to do very well in, he got over 20% of the vote. He wasn't doing well. Even during the last debate that he had with Bernie Sanders, he said he had run out of money. He admitted it if he ran out of money. Well, you're out of money and you're not getting it very far with financial resources. What happened? The establishment decided Joe Biden was the guy. And so Super Tuesday comes along. Remember that Biden, after he lost those three races, before Super Tuesday comes along, after Biden lost those three races, what did he do? Made a beeline to South Carolina because he always had a shot at winning there. And he did. And he performed spectacularly well there in comparison to his other these other contests. Too well. And so what happens after South Carolina? Now you've got a certified winner because Joe hadn't won primaries up to that point. You got a certified win for Joe. And so now you're able to say, this guy can win a primary. Took long enough, but he can win a presidential primary. Now we can stack the deck for Joe. In the Super Tuesday states, Joe had little to no presence there. He didn't even campaign there. That's not what you normally do when you're a presidential candidate. You don't normally try to go into a major contest like Super Tuesday, which, in my view, is the determining factor or one of the big factors in the presidential race. I don't look at Iowa and New Hampshire as much. I look at Super Tuesday. Guess what happened with Super Tuesday? Joe wins a slew of states, including Massachusetts. Now, Joe was, as a potential winner, Bernie Sanders was. In fact, that's Elizabeth Warren's state that she represents in the Senate. But guess who won Massachusetts? Joe Biden. He came out of nowhere to win the Super Tuesday, not only Massachusetts, but other states, especially Texas. He came out of nowhere to win these states with little to no infrastructure, with no campaigning. That, if that doesn't tell you something isn't right, nothing else will. This stinks. It's clear to me that they stole these states for Joe. They stole them. I mean, the fix is in. I mean, there's no doubt in they just decided we're just gonna have Joe win these states. And they couldn't win all the states. They couldn't win all the states. You know, Bernie managed to win California and he won Colorado and I think Vermont as well. He won some states, but it was very evident that the establishment went out of their way to to make sure that Joe was going to win and win big on Super Tuesday. And he's been winning ever since.
Casey, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
I mean, they were never going to let us win to begin with. But, yeah, I think, like in Illinois, Amy Klobuchar, to the best of my knowledge, still has absolutely zero votes cast for her. And she was still in the race, like, what, 2 or 3 weeks ago? You mean to tell me that no one that mailed in early, no fool out there that thought Amy Klobuchar should be our president, cast a ballot?
You mean Minnesota? You mean Minnesota?
No, no.
Tuesday?
No, not for Super Tuesday, for a pursuant election. Oh. Like, she literally
Illinois
no
was
votes. Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, I'm sure they're still counting votes, but still it's rather strange. Illinois is also famously corrupt.
Yeah, Illinois was, people probably are aware of what happened in Illinois, right? They were coming out results or knowing about results fairly early on. Very suspicious stuff going on. I mean, I mean, I'm not saying this, to just state that this is some kind of grand conspiracy or that this is some deep twisted cabal like move. I mean, this is pretty open stuff. I mean, it's not open that they're stealing, but you can tell that this isn't legit. It makes no sense. It makes no sense as somebody who's covered elections on a local basis, and it doesn't make any sense looking at this on a national basis. It's very clear. They didn't want Bernie Sanders to win again. He was winning. That was scaring them. And they had to stop him.
It's very interesting. I'm seeing a lot of pundits say, oh, this Biden thing may be really bad now, given the coronavirus crisis, the pandemic. And they're saying, throw anyone in there. I saw one saying, throw anyone in there. Throw Warren in there. Just whoever. And I'm thinking to myself, Bernie's still there. He's still there. And they're just acting like he doesn't exist.
Again, you have to look at the fact that some of these candidates could have hung on a little longer, but they didn't. It's very clear that they were forced out. Now, here's an interesting point. Some people might not find it interesting, but I find it interesting. This has been my assessment and then my analysis. Marianne Williamson was arguing with someone. Now, she had run for president earlier, like last year, the Democratic Party ticket. She was saying on Twitter that she and a few other candidates were being pressured to drop out. She was saying this. Now, I'll be quite frank. I'm not a fan of Marianne Williamson, period, and I'm not into her business, quote-unquote, whatever it is that she does. I mean, I know she's a spiritual leader, quote-unquote. But I think she has a point. And I said so on Twitter. And I laid out some of what I mentioned here on Twitter. But she stated that she was pressured to drop out. And she said other candidates were too. And I believe that's precisely what happened. Now, I will say right up front, I believe in this essence, I believe what she has to say. I can agree with it. I think they wanted to get some of these candidates out and clear the field for Joe and make it a clear path to nomination or as clear a path to nomination as they could. Not because they love Joe, not because they like Joe. They'd rather have somebody else. But hey, Joe's better than Bernie in the establishment's point of view. They want someone they can control as opposed to somebody they can't really control. And they feel they probably can't control Bernie Sanders.
The only thing I will add to that, I think the clearest difference between Bernie Sanders and Biden, we're seeing it right now. I mean, Bernie Sanders is using his campaign to raise funds for people vulnerable or affected by the coronavirus. What is Joe Biden doing? Bernie Sanders is doing teleconferences, basically live streams to talk about coronavirus to the public. What is Joe Biden doing? And at the end of the day, I think the big difference is, regardless what you think of Bernie Sanders, and one of the reasons the establishment doesn't like him is because he believes in things. He has certain principles. And to the establishment, they use the term ideologue to describe him. That's their way of diminishing anyone who has some type of principles. Joe Biden, on the other hand, right. as we can see in the new book, Branko Marcetek's The Case Against Joe Biden, an excellent read, Joe Biden doesn't believe in anything. Joe Biden has gone from right to left-ish to right-ish to left-ish. He doesn't believe in anything. And that's sort of mm-hmm. who the DNC wants. They want a blank slate.
Right. I think that's a very good point. You know, for the establishment and through most of American politics, principles are negotiable. So if you look at what's happening now, I think a good question to ask, and others have asked it, is where's Joe? Where is he right now? What's going on? We know what Bernie's doing. We know what Senator Sanders is doing. He's out there trying to marshal resources financially and otherwise to get money and resources to people impacted by COVID-19 and the coronavirus. What's Joe doing? Maybe he gave a speech about it, but outside of that, we don't know. And it shows you the difference between leadership and languishing. Bernie Sanders is a leader. Joe Biden is languishing. And, you know, if you need any clear indication of the difference between these two, you could see it in what's gone on with this crisis and what's going on with this crisis right now. And Joe has always been a total and complete joke as a politician. He really has.
I was just going to add real quick. I've often said that Joe Biden is almost the George W. Bush for Democrats. He's the aw shucks type character that doesn't believe in anything and talks in this like gaffe machine manner that I guess our elites think is endearing to the public.
But here's the difference. George W. Bush is a far smarter individual than Joe Biden. Now, a lot of people think that George W. Bush was kind of a simpleton and a moron. He perhaps was not the greatest policy. He was in a policy wonk and perhaps not the greatest policy president. But George W. Bush was no imbecile, and he was no moron. He was far smarter than people gave him credit for, far sharper. You know, you grow up in a family like that, especially establishment political family, you know more about politics than a lot of other people. And George W. Bush worked on campaigns of his father, George H.W. Bush. So he was around presidential politics. A lot of what went on with George W. Bush in terms of his campaign, I don't want to say that it was an act or that he was acting entirely, but a little bit of it was a show. A little bit of it. It's pretty clear that Bush had an understanding that Bush was, not a fool. I mean, you know, Yale graduate, Harvard Business School graduate. You know, you can't be a complete and utter nincompoop and go to those schools. You have to have at least some brain cells. You've got to have at least something going on there. And, I've always been kind of worried about the whole George W. Bush thing. I think he's a far sharper politician. A far sharper person than he was ever given credit for. But part of that is it worked for him. It worked for him to be underestimated. Joe, however, I believe is the real deal. I mean, this is a guy who was the outstanding student as a political science student. And he was not the only thing he was is an outstanding liar. This is a guy who graduated 70-something out of his law school class of 85 or 86. I mean, that's bottom half of his class. This guy is no genius. He's no brilliant individual. He's a lightweight. He's a true lightweight. True lightweight. And it's pretty evident not only in terms of the way he's conducted himself over the years, but the way he's conducting himself now.
Speaking of geniuses, I think a lot of Tulsi Gabbard supporters feel like they have egg on their face right now. And of course, Albert, you're from Hawaii. We've talked about Tulsi together. You are not a big fan. Let's close out the show with some of your commentary on Tulsi dropping out of the presidential race.
Again, I hate to use the term "I told you so," but I did tell people so. And what's, I think, appalling about Tulsi is the shamelessness of her opportunism. I've known that she's a rank and raw and sort of awkward political opportunist for years. This is something I've seen for several years now, at least since she's been in the Congress. The reality is that Tulsi has gone out of her way, and this is a larger argument, which I won't get into, but Tulsi has gone out of her way to sort of create this Trojan horse. This Trojan horse that is her, not only her career in the Congress, but also her candidacy as president. And this woman who constructed a presidential campaign of being against regime change wars and supposedly being against war, being somewhat anti-war, I say kind of conveniently anti-war, and embellishing her military credentials and pretending to be progressive. I mean, being a progressive, pretending to be progressive, being actually progressive. But actually, this woman who is kind of led with a sort of foreign policy critique of this country is going to turn around and then endorse the guy who voted for the Iraq war and is essentially a warmonger. Maybe not as bad a warmonger as Hillary Clinton, but still a warmonger. So she's going to critique Hillary Clinton. They call her what? The queen of warmongers or something along that line. But she winds up being sued, actually, by, I think, Hillary and her people. But then she's going to turn around after running past the point that all other candidates had dropped out, and then decide she's going to endorse Joe Biden, who's the kind of the embodiment of supposedly what she's campaigning against. You can't make this up. I've said before that she's interested in, number one, that she's nothing more than an opportunist, that she will zig and zag at the same time. People can't figure her out. Well, I think they're beginning to figure her out a little. And it's pretty clear that she's willing to sell out to anyone. And in this case, the establishment of the Democratic Party, who she supposedly campaigned against, she's willing to sell out to them if it will benefit her in some way. And we'll see what that benefit is. We will see. But this tells you everything about Tulsi that I have stated for several years. It just tells you everything.
Well, hey, Albert Lanier, I wanted to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. If you could, yes, just let my listeners know how they can get a hold of your work.
Oh, well, you can look at my blog. I haven't written anything new, but you can go to my blog, which is at medium.com/@the Dr. 50. But my blog is at medium.com. I can read my old blog pieces. I'm also on Twitter @Critic Incorporated. And I'm also on Facebook. I think it's facebook.com/AlbertLanier. I forget, or is it AlbertLanier@facebook.com? I forget the link for Facebook, but Albert Lanier on Facebook. And on Twitter, Kredic Incorporated. And medium.com, my blog is there, which is medium.com/@thedoctor50. So you can see me on Twitter and Facebook and read my blog if you wish.
And Casey, if you could, take us out.
Stay safe, stay strong, solidarity forever.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with veteran journalist and friend of the show. He's become something of a semi-regular guest, Albert Lanier. I think he provides an always interesting, unique, and different take than most consider when it comes to current events and hot topics in the news today. And I hope that was no different this time around as we talked about the coronavirus pandemic and the crisis, not only in healthcare, but economically as well. As always, you can drop me a line giving me your thoughts on this edition of Parallax Views by contacting me on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. If you can, please consider supporting me on Twitter, and only if you can afford it in these trying times. I could really use the support if you can, but if not, I completely understand. A little bit behind on the Patreon stuff right now, but should have a lot of new material and archived bonus content from previous editions of the show for Patreon supporters by the end of this month. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.